Mitchell Klein, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. When I first crawled into these rooms, I weighed close to 300 pounds. I shook, I stank. I didn't think I belonged here. I had been drinking on a daily basis, and I was married at the time. My wife kept leaving these AA pamphlets all around the house. I kept throwing them out. Then she got intelligent and put them in the bathroom, took all the magazines out of the bathroom, and when I went to work in the morning, there was the only one thing to read while sitting there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and having to read something, I read it. I still threw them out, and I still didn't belong. Eventually, I was visiting my parents in New York City. I lived upstate, and I took a walk because I couldn't drink in their house, and I was, as usual, drunk, and walked past the church and saw this little circle and triangle emblem out in front of the church, and there it was, and walked in. I was the youngest person in the room. A bunch of old-timers came in and said, you know, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, stick it in your mouth. They held me. They told me, you know, basically follow directions, don't drink and go to meetings, and I did that for 5 years. Then I went to a meeting one night, and I had been reading the big book that some sneaky person handed me, and what I was reading in the book was not in the rooms. The stories that I was reading wasn't there in the room. So I went to a meeting one night, and a guy walked in who was chairing the meeting and said, came home, had a bad day at work, slammed the door, kicked the dog, yelled at the kids, and almost hit the wife, but I didn't take a drink, and it's okay. Everybody in the room said, you know, you're a winner, kid, and I applauded, and keep coming back. I kind of ran out of that room crying, and I went on a spiritual search. I went and found somebody who had what I wanted, somebody who had what was in the book, and that basically was, you know, a changed life, putting God in my life. I can't say since I've been through the steps in my sixth year of sobriety, my life has been totally wonderful. It's been up, it's been down. I've been through all my not yets. I've been divorced twice. Arrested, homeless, everything else, all in recovery, but it's okay because God provided. He may not have provided what I wanted, but He provided exactly what I needed. And I'm just real grateful for rooms like this, and Wilson House, and Dr. Bob's, and Stepping Stones, and rooms that I can walk into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in just about every country in the world, and know that I'm home. Because people may be speaking with different accents, different languages, but we're all the same. And that's it for my qualification. I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, Wally P. from Tucson, Arizona.
Thank you, Mitchell. My name is Wally, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. By the grace of God, this simple program and your love, patience, and tolerance, haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. And for that, I am eternally grateful. My sobriety date is October 30th, 1988. And the reason that I give my sobriety date, as I've been on this spiritual journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the destinations was Springfield, Missouri. I was asked to speak there at a state convention. And I'd heard about the folks in Missouri and Texas and Oklahoma all identifying themselves and giving their sobriety date before they spoke. And when I got off the plane, I met with my host, Jody, and I said, Jody, I've heard that folks in this area of the country identify themselves and give a sobriety date. I said, we don't do that where I'm from in Arizona. I said, what do you think? Should I do it here? And he said, oh, Wally, you can do anything you want. The only thing that we have to say is that if you don't give your sobriety date, you don't have one. So that was more than just a suggestion at the time. So since that time, I have been giving my sobriety date no matter where I am. As you can tell, I'm relatively new in sobriety. It's been a glorious journey, a spiritual journey and an archival journey all rolled into one. I do want to explain how that all came about, because that combination of spiritual and archival journey has brought us all together tonight here at the Wilson House in East Dorset, Vermont. And I'm just so grateful to be here. This is my third trip. And as I said earlier, Ozzy and Bonnie are just two of the most special people in my life. And I'm just so grateful to be here and so grateful that you've been so kind and patient with me today in terms of this archival presentation on the AA, the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century. It's the first time I've ever done 9 hours of the history of AA. And I think I said earlier about being guided to do it as a slideshow within the last 2 weeks. So it was a kind of hectic and frantic putting all this together. And it was still being put together as I was being rushed to the airport to be poured on the airplane to get here. Still being put on. I'll be working later tonight on additional material for tomorrow to get the slides in order, and hopefully not too many of them upside down like they have been earlier. But I want to start right in the middle. That's a great place for an alcoholic to start. At 1 year of sobriety, my sponsor sat me down, and he said, "Wally, I'm not going to be alive much longer. And but if you remember these two things, you may not find it necessary to take another drink as long as you live." And he did die shortly after this conversation, and it meant a lot to me what he had to say. He said, number one, if you don't remember your last drink, you haven't taken it. And number two, if you don't know where we came from, you'll never know what a miracle this program truly is. And I am going to follow up on both of those statements. First, in terms of my last drink. My last drink was on October 30th, 1988. It was 7 o'clock in the morning, approximately. I was coming off another one of my many benders. And I was in my parents' combination grain room and chicken coop in Patagonia, Arizona. It's a little town outside of Tucson up in the mountains. 4,000 feet elevation, and population 700, twice the size of East Dorset, Vermont, but with just about as many amenities, other than the fact that it did have 3 bars. It had more bars than churches. Typical Wild West town. And I was drinking my way off a bender, and it was 7 o'clock in the morning, and then I was just throwing down a couple of beers before breakfast. I knew that was the only way to get rid of the shakes because my parents, my mom had served breakfast ready, and I couldn't even hold the fork. I was shaking so badly. And I was just there just looking over at the chickens and chickens looking back at me, and I realized this was not social drinking. And that turned out to be a turning point in my life, that this was not social drinking. And I'm just so grateful that that did turn out to be my last drink. 5 days later, I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic, and I've been coming back ever since. In terms of how I got to that chicken coop, I'm going to take you back just a little while before that. I try to keep my drunkalogue portion to an absolute minimum. I do want to qualify so that you know I've earned the right to be here. But I was attending a meeting. It was actually the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. Some of you know Clancy I and the L.A. area has the largest group in AA. And on Wednesday nights they meet in this Jewish synagogue. And they pack in as many as 2,000-3,000 people on a Wednesday night. And I was there with my significant other, Mickey, and her daughter, Tanya. And Tanya could use this program and has not found us. So we had taken her to this meeting, which we thought would be, you know, the greatest meeting on earth, because Clancy always says it is. Well, Clancy didn't speak that night, but there were 3 speakers, and I'll have to admit, I was quite disappointed. I thought it was a drunkalogue meeting. But at the end of the meeting, Mickey turns to Tanya and says, "Well, what did you think?" And Tanya said, well, Mom, I know how to drink. What I need to learn is how to stay sober. And that was just such a profound statement to me after listening to those three drunkologues. More importantly, I think, for Clancy's standpoint, is that Mickey was so upset, she chased him down in the parking lot and tore him up one side and down the other. And I've never seen Clancy back up to anybody before or since. But he did take it to heart, and he said, I hear what you're saying, and I'm going to take it to the group next week, and we'll make sure that the next time you come and bring your daughter that we talk about the solution and not just the problem. So I try to stay out of the problem as much as I can. But there are a couple instances that I think are of significance. One is in the Vietnam War. I was in the United States Seabees. Actually, I drank my way out of Georgia Tech. I never had a problem drinking, but I drank my way out of Georgia Tech. They actually terminated me as a student for belligerent activities on and off campus. On drunken sprees, I lost my scholarship. Ended up being sucked up in the draft and went to Vietnam. But I went as a Navy Seabee. But we were still ground pounders, and we still were getting shot at, and we were still out there mucking it up in the trenches. And I was with we were in the construction corps, and I was with an Arvin sergeant that was with a South Vietnamese Army Construction Battalion. We were walking through a village, and there were thousands of people mulling in the village square. And then all of a sudden, a North Vietnamese comes out of the crowd with a loaded revolver and picks it up and points it right at the Arvin sergeant and pulls the trigger. And I watched him fall right beside me. I don't have time to even move, let alone reach for my weapon, because in the next instant he just took the gun and put it in my chest. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and what seemed like an eternity waiting for the gun to go off, it didn't. And he pulled it back and went back into the crowd. And I was quite disappointed, because I had expected to die in Vietnam. In fact, I was looking forward to it, because I was in so much pain over the alcoholism, and at that time a drug addiction, that I was just waiting for the final shoe to drop. And a couple Army guys came over and said, "My God, we saw what happened. What a miracle. You must really, really have God on your side." And I didn't want to hear anything about this God thing. In fact, I thought God had really let me down, that this was my chance to go out in a blaze of glory, but he let me live. And I was on the run from God ever since that incident. I just wanted no part of a God that would allow me to live when I wanted to die. I came back from Vietnam quite addicted. I'm going to make sure that I don't go any further on the drug story and nip that in the bud right now. I do believe that we talk about alcoholism and alcoholism alone in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are other 12-step programs to discuss other afflictions and addictions and obsessions and compulsions. Talking to some of the old-timers, a couple of things that I've learned is, well, one is that I cannot recover from a disease that doesn't exist. And you can contact the AMA or look in any medical journals, and there is no such disease as alcohol addictism. It does not exist. So how can I recover from something that does not exist? And also it sets me apart from, rather than a part of, this fellowship. And I think I mentioned earlier that the original title, non-published title of our big book was Alcoholics Anonymous, period, because of the period that was on the circus dust jacket. And I also feel compelled to identify myself as an alcoholic, period, as a result of that. So I will not go any further in terms of drugs other than the fact that I came back from Vietnam addicted and stayed addicted for quite some time, but I want to concentrate on the alcoholism. Because I did find that living on the streets of Hollywood as a street junkie, that there's parts of this world that aren't very pretty, and I was living as deep in the darkness as anybody could live. I explained that I was in I was at Woodstock. That actually was 2 weeks after my return from Vietnam, and I was in such I was so confused. Dazed and confused, coming back from Vietnam, being thrown right back into this country that I understood nothing about anymore, and then the Woodstock rock concert, and realizing that that was just part of an overriding movement that also was part of the darkness. I come to believe that. I left the United States and went to Mexico, just like you saw if anybody watched Born on 4th of July. I also left Vietnam, spent a very little time in the United States, and went to Mexico to feel at home, back to the jungles. I just could not identify with this country after coming back from Vietnam and what I'd seen and what I'd been through, and also how I'd been treated. I tried to get a job in Hollywood at one time, this is when I was trying to get off the streets, and put my resume out, and went, and one of the personnel directors looked at my resume and said, we don't have anything for you. We don't have anything for drug addicts and baby killers. And I'd never killed any babies, but I kind of understood the negative feeling that most people had about Vietnam veterans coming back. It's taken over 20 years for those wounds to heal for many of us. I did continue with my active alcoholism all the way to Seattle. And in 1976, I got a DWI and ended up losing my license for 30 days. This is a point in time where if I'd been exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if it would have mattered, but I wasn't. I think it was interesting that in Seattle, Washington, in 1976, they were not sending people to AA. At that time, they were sending people to 4 one-hour classes, but it was Alcohol Awareness School. And you had to go every Tuesday night. And my ex-wife, one of my ex-wives, that's another story that I'll save for another 12-step program, one of my 4 ex-wives, one of the 4 victims, or hostages, that's what they say, right? We don't get married, we take hostages. She was driving me to the classes. The instructor at the first class stood up in front of us and says, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but we've been teaching this class long enough to know the 20 of you that are in this room, somewhere between 14 and 16 of you are alcoholics. And I looked around the room and saying, I wonder who they are. There's some alcoholics in this room. And I got thinking, geez, isn't it bad enough that they took my license away for 30 days, but now they're going to force me to sit in a room full of alcoholics? And I sat in that room for those classes. And we got together after the classes, waiting for our various rides, at this bar across the street. And we'd throw down a couple and talk about wondering who the alcoholics were. By the time the last class came around, there were about 12 of us in the bar, all of us non-alcoholics, trying to figure out who the alcoholics were that are in this DWI class. I told that story in Springfield, Missouri, on that same visit where Jody told me about why they identify and give their sobriety dates in Missouri. And a guy comes up to the podium after that, and he said, do you remember what class you were in? And I said, well, I know it was in the spring. And he said, I think I was in your class. And I said, "My God, I don't remember you." And he says, "That's because I wasn't in the bar across the street. I stayed sober." And it did, but the difference was, for some reason, he already had been exposed to AA, and he was going to these classes in AA together. And he made it. And to find him many years later, sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous in Springfield, Missouri, left absolute chills up and down my spine. But that's the kind of alcoholic I was. Total denial that I had a problem. Drank for another 13 years after that, and ended up drinking my way to Patagonia one more time in the middle of the summer of 1988, and got to the Big Steer Bar in Patagonia with about 14, 16 ounces of alcohol in my system. And there was a new bartender, and the bartender said, "I like him sauntering over the bar," because it was a new young lady behind the bar. And I stagger over and saunter up to the bar and said, "You're new here, aren't you?" And she says, "Yeah, my name is Sandra, and I am filling in for the summer on the weekends." And she said, "I'm from Tucson." And I said, "Oh, really? I'm Wally, and I'm from Tucson also." And then the shyness kicked in that kind of kept me from making contact with people except with alcohol in my system. As Peter said when he introduced me this morning, I spent most of my time in chemistry labs isolated from people, very shy, very withdrawn. And even with the alcohol, I didn't have anything to say. And all of a sudden, I just looked at her and I said, "Wow, that's a beautiful piece of jewelry that you have around your neck. What is that circle and triangle all about?" And she said, "Oh, that's the symbol for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "Really? I've never met an alcoholic before." True story, that's what I said. And she said, "Well, I am one. Now, what would you like to drink?" And I said, "Well, I'll have a Diet Coke." Didn't want her to think I was an alcoholic. But I think she suspected something. And imagine me, that drunk, sitting in a bar, drinking Diet Coke. I couldn't even sit on the bar stool. But went back the next night sober to talk to her because of that circle and triangle. And we made a deal, and the deal was that she would allow me to take her out to dinner. She gave me her phone number. If I would accompany her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I agreed, and I got her phone number, and I took her out to dinner the next Saturday night, and went to my first AA meeting 5 months later. And so I kept stalling and stalling and stalling. The time came, which turned out to be the weekend after I was in the chicken coop, that we were going to a meeting. And she said, it's time. You've stalled long enough. And then I said, "Well, I can't go to a meeting in Tucson. I'm a big shot middle manager for a Fortune 500 company." Well, little did I know that I was just in the process of being fired from my third Fortune 500 company. And I was losing everything for the third time. And she said, "Oh, okay, Wally, if you don't want to go to a meeting in Tucson, okay. Well, how about Phoenix? It's only 2 hours away, but we can get there." I said, "Oh, no, cannot go to a meeting in Phoenix. I used to live in Phoenix. I used to live in Scottsdale. I mean, what if I went to a meeting up there and somebody saw me? What would they think? Somebody like me going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she rolled her eyes and said, "Well, they're probably there for the same reason you are, to learn something about alcoholism. It doesn't mean anything." I said, "Oh, no, I know what it means. It means that they're going to think I'm an alcoholic." Talk about denial. This is the denial that almost killed me. At this point in time, my liver and kidneys had already shut down. I was in intense pain. I could not even continue to drink around the clock like I used to or wanted to because of the pain in my side. And the only time I stopped drinking was I stopped drinking long enough for the pain to go away. Little did I know that that was kidneys and liver shutting down permanently. I'm still in denial and can't go to a meeting with her And she says, okay, where are we going to go with this meeting? And I said, how about Sedona, Arizona? So Sandra and I drove 5.5 hours across the Tucson desert for me to go to a meeting where I would not be noticed and or identified as an alcoholic. And we drove these 5.5 hours pretty much in silence. I was petrified. And we get to Stutz Bearcat Drive, which is where this meeting is being held, and it's down in a basement. And I panicked before going in, and I said, hold on. I can't go in there until you tell me exactly what's going to happen. I want to know exactly what's going to happen. I don't want any surprises, because I've never been to a meeting. And here I am still shaking it out after 5 days without a drink. The pain in my side was still so intense, I couldn't start drinking again anyway that day. And she said, well, nothing's going to happen because you're just going to sit down and keep your mouth shut and watch and listen. And I said, oh, I can do that. Well, I couldn't do that because I'd never been here before. And at the opening of the meeting, somebody said, is there somebody here attending their first AA meeting or in their first 30 days of sobriety? And I put my hand up. It wasn't anybody else putting their hand up, but I put my hand up. And I said, my name's Wally, and I'm from Tucson. And this is my first AA meeting. How do you like that? And they liked it just fine. Little did I know that that was a signal, a trigger. They didn't, right in front of me, declare it a first step meeting. But they did choose the topic for the meeting to be turning points. As we read in chapter 5, we stood at the turning point. And the topic of the meeting was the turning points that had brought each and every one of those people in the rooms to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did listen. I don't remember much of what I heard except for the fact that I did identify enough to realize that I just might have a problem and chose not to drink after that meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. But that meeting ended up being a turning point in my life. Just by sitting in a room, listening to other alcoholics discussing the turning points that brought them into AA, turned out to be the turning point in my life, which brought me into AA. The second meeting I attended was in Tucson, and it was a speaker meeting. I didn't know anything about speaker meetings, but Sandra was dragging me to these things. I decided, okay, I've been to a meeting, now I can go to another one. But little I know that Dr. Paul was the speaker. Dr. Paul and Max, Dr. Paul's stories in the big book, The Bronze Moccasins. Oh, they named it something else, but I won't get into that. But that's the original title of it. Everybody knows Dr. Alcoholic Addict. I purposely picked her up late. And we got there late because I didn't want to go in the first place, and she dragged me in anyway. And I looked in the crowd. There was about almost 1,000 people in there, and I said, oh, no, I can't go in here. And I said, there aren't even any chairs. And she says, no problem. So she drags me down to the front and puts me right in front of the podium on the floor and sits me down there and says, just stay where you are. And there I'm sitting, and Max speaks first. She's the Al-Anon. And I thought, that's pretty good. And nobody's staring at me. They're all staring at her. And then Dr. Paul gets up, and he says he hasn't done it in a while. I've talked to Dr. Paul about it, but back in the late 80s, he was doing this almost everywhere he went. And he said, I want to make sure that I'm in the right room. Will all the alcoholics please put up your hands? And out of the room, about 900 hands go up. And he says, and how about the Al-Anons? And all the rest of the hands go up. And there's 999 hands up, and mine is the only one that isn't. And he looks right down at me. And he says, and for you alcoholics who did not put up your hand, I welcome you because you're my kind of alcoholic. And he spent the rest of the meeting talking about denial. Oh, my. Talk about people just taking me under their wing. I mean, here's Dr. Paul not knowing me, but he looked around, and mine was the only hand that wasn't up. And he saw that. I continued to go to meetings, and I continued to deny I was an alcoholic until Christmas of that year. And that's where God took over and struck me down as low as a guy could get, but it's what it took to get me here as a recovered alcoholic. I woke up the night before Christmas. This is 60 days into sobriety, or 60 days into dryness without a drink, just going to meetings, absolutely doing nothing else. And I woke up in this intense pain, and my vision was blurred, and I couldn't even get out of bed without falling down. And so I'm crawling around the house on my hands and knees. And I've been here before. In fact, I've been in that state many times. I know what had happened. And the thought crossed my mind that maybe you people were right. Maybe I am an alcoholic. Because you kept talking about this thing called blackouts. And I'd never had a blackout before, but maybe this was my first blackout. I must have gotten drunk last night, or I couldn't feel as bad as I felt today. And I kept thinking about that blackout. Oh my God. I've been drinking and not even knowing it. Well, it didn't get any better. In fact, it actually got worse. Christmas Eve, I did not go over to see Sandra. I called on the phone and told her I never wanted to see her again. And that the presents were out in the driveway for Christmas. Nice way of saying thank you to the woman that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Christmas morning, got on an automobile and drove to Patagonia with a fishing pole in my hand. And I got to my parents' doorstep and told them that I wanted to go to Mexico to go fishing, and I couldn't take my car across the border, and I needed to trade my car in for one of their cars that was certified to go into Mexico with Mexican insurance. And my dad looks at me and says, "You been drinking?" And I says, "No, I haven't been drinking. I just want to go to Mexico and go fishing." And he says, "Well, you sure sound like you're drunk. No, I'm not going to loan you the car. Go back to Tucson." So I was acting alcoholically, as a practicing alcoholic, big time, and my dad wouldn't even touch me. And he said, "Just get out of here." And he sent me back to Tucson. And I went back. I don't remember much else because I was going in and out of these fits of depression and fits of, actually, the pain was so intense I couldn't see. And the day after Christmas, it struck me that I'd already cut myself off from my only link to AA by telling Sandra I didn't ever want to see her again. And I finally picked up the telephone and called the phone number for Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book. And thank God there was somebody on the other end of the line. And thank God it was the person, probably the only person in the city of Tucson at the time that could have handled that call. And I told him that I was not an alcoholic. I realized by then that I had not been out drinking, but there was something really wrong with me. I'm having all of these symptoms of active alcoholism, complete with the hangovers, but I'm not drinking. And I needed a doctor that would understand this. And I was asking for a referral. I didn't know that they don't give referrals at intergroup offices, but that's what he said. He said, "I can't do that over the phone here, but if you could come down and we could talk, can you drive?" And I said, "Yes, I think I can drive." And so I drove down just like I used to drive, and one eye closed and trying to drive between the four lines instead of two, which is what I was seeing. But I did get to the intergroup office about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the man that was on the phone, John, was there to greet me, and he sat me down, and we started talking. And that's what we did for about 2.5, 3 hours, was just talk. He talked, I talked, he talked, I talked. And he answered the phones in between and took calls and told people where meetings were and all the things that people at intergroup offices do. But then about 5:30, he said, Walt, we're getting ready to close down the office, and you've been telling me all these reasons that you're not an alcoholic. Can you just summarize those reasons again for me? And I said, oh, absolutely, John. He said, well, first of all, how can I be an alcoholic if I haven't had a drink in 60 days? I mean, isn't that proof positive that I'm not an alcoholic? And he says, oh, Wally, we have a book here. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's several stories in here about people who haven't had a drink for as long as 30 years, but they're still alcoholics. And I said, oh, I don't believe that, John. I know, at least for me, that 60 days is long enough to prove that I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, well, most people that aren't alcoholics can stop for a year. Do you think you can stop for a year? And I says, absolutely not. Why would I want to stop for a year? He says, well, how about 90 days? And I said, well, I'll think about 90 days. I thought 60 was enough. And he said, okay, what else? And I said, well, I'm a middle manager of a Fortune. I kept using those lines. God, I was just an entry-level salesperson because I kept getting fired from all these jobs. Told him I was a middle manager for a Fortune 500 company, and I have this big new car out in the parking lot, which it was a company car that they were coming to take away in another 3 weeks because I was getting fired again. And I have this big, beautiful home up in the northwest side of Tucson. And he said, oh, you live up on the northwest side? Where do you live? And I said, well, I live in Ina and La Cañada. And he says, oh, really? I live in that neighborhood. What's the address? And I told him the address. And he says, well, I'll be. I live three doors down from you. And I said to myself, oh, my God, now I'm going to have to move out of the neighborhood. I've got an alcoholic living three doors down from me. Oh, my God, that's such a... I thought it was such a nice neighborhood. and then he says, okay, why else? And I says, well, I mean, I have a bachelor's degree and I have a master's degree, and I couldn't do that if I was an alcoholic, could I? And he says, well, Wally, I don't know about you, but I'm an alcoholic, and this is my card. And it read, John P., PhD, Professor of Electrical Engineering, University of Arizona. I had been one-upped by a PhD over my master's degree. And I ran out of excuses. I had finally run out of excuses. And like I said, I don't think there was anybody else that could have handled that call other than John. Because the next thing he says was, Wally, I know you're in intense pain. He says, and I'm your neighbor. He says, go to a meeting tonight. And since you have 60 days, get your 60-day chip and go home and just hang on to that. And if you feel just as bad tomorrow as you feel today, I will personally take you down to a doctor that can help you. I can't do it here working out of the office, but I'll do that for you tomorrow. And I said, oh, I know what you're trying to do. He said, I've been to these meetings. I can't get a 60-day chip without identifying myself as an alcoholic. He says, oh, I just keep forgetting, Wally, that you're not an alcoholic. But you're a salesperson, aren't you? And I says, ah, yes, I'm a good salesperson. And he says, well, why don't you just pretend you're an alcoholic and go down and get your chip? Just pretend, just this once. And I said, well, okay, I will do that. So I drove across town again, one eye open, one eye closed, to the meeting at the Northwest Club. Got there just as the meeting was started. Had never been to this meeting. I'd never met any of these people in the room. And at 60 days, when they were asking about the chips, I stood up and I said, my name is Wally and I'm an alcoholic. And I went up to get my 60-day chip. And it was as much a turning point in my life, as much of a spiritual experience as Bill Wilson had at Towns Hospital. The pain lifted instantaneously. And all of a sudden the room came into focus and this blur became people. And these people became human beings. And I wasn't even afraid to go up to get that chip. And I've never had the pain since, and I am so grateful that whatever God did to me during that three-day period was just enough to get me to finally admit that I was an alcoholic. And what I found absolutely uncanny is that that's all I had to do. My name is Wally, and I'm an alcoholic. And my life changed. Well, it kept changing after that, and big time after getting into the group. Got a sponsor that was a very, very hard-nosed sponsor from, you know, the old school, back to basics. Very few of these people left today. I was most fortunate to have him. Told me I had to read this book, and I'll get into that in a minute, but I was working my way through it the first time, and he said, oh, Wally, what do you think of this book? And I said, well, I don't think a lot of it. And he said, well, okay, do you think you're going to make it? And I says, really don't think so, Phil. He says, why not? And I says, there's God in this book. The G-O-D word's in this book. He says, oh, you don't believe, do you? I said, oh, absolutely not. My God is the God of science. I'm a chemist. Why would I want to believe in stuff like this? And he said, well, that's okay, Wally. You don't have to believe. And I said, what? I don't have to believe? He says, no, absolutely not. He said, do you believe that I believe in this book? And I says, well, Phil, I think it's pretty obvious that you believe in this book. Because here you crawled out from under a bridge in Long Beach, California some 20 years ago, and now you're wealthy, and now you've got your life in order, and you seem to be plugged into this AA thing. And I said, yeah, I believe that you believe. And he says, do you think there's anybody else in this room of Alcoholics Anonymous that believes? And I said, yeah, Flint, I know Flint believes, and there's another lady over there, I think she believes. And he said, well, that's all you need. All you have to believe is that we believe. And that was the beginning. And so, again, for the first year, I could say that that group was my higher power. But at least it was enough to get me started. I believed that Phil believed. And then he said, and then I made the mistake, big time, about 95, 100 days into sobriety, of bring up the topic at this meeting. It was a discussion group. And they asked for topics, and I raised my hand. One thing I learned early, because I was in such fear of people, is that if you brought up the topic, you didn't have to speak. So rather than get called on, which I hated, and I tried to avoid like the plague, I tried bringing up topics. And the topic I brought up is, why isn't there an advanced textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, I read this thing twice. Where is the advanced course? Where's the heart of the program? I mean, this is just the basics, right? And I got hammered pretty hard at that meeting. Crucified, I think. I mean, a little closer to the truth. I was bleeding pretty bad when I was in the parking lot. My ego had been shattered pretty badly. And Phil said, out in the parking lot, he took me under his wing again and said, you know, every time I've opened this book, I've found something new in it. And he said, my sponsor told me that if I ever got through the first 164 pages of this book without finding something new, that I could read the stories. And he said, you know, in 20 years, I've never read the stories in the back of this book. And I said, Phil, I don't believe that. And he said, well, just try it. So what I did is I got some magic markers, and I went home, and I went through the book and started marking. First with one color, and then I go back through the book in another color, and then I'd go back through the book in another color, and it was amazing that each time I went through the book, I did find something new in this. And I realized that he's right. You don't need an advanced textbook. That everything that I need to stay sober is in here, because every time I open this book, I find something new in it, because every time I open this book, it's another day, and my life has changed, and I'm further along in my spiritual journey. And myself, like Phil, I have to pass on that I do not need anything other than this book. in terms of my recovery. Everything that I need is right in here in the first 164 pages. But it did take seven or eight trips. If you don't know where we came from, you'll never know what a miracle this program truly is. That turned out to be another turning point. That turned out to be my spiritual experience. The 12th step spiritual experience. I had worked the steps. I had done my inventories. I was making my restitutions. And, one thing in the, after I got hammered in the parking lot about bringing up about the advanced textbook, Phil took all my books away. He said, while you're getting all caught up in these Hazleton guides and this these other outside books, he says, if you want me to continue to be your sponsor, you're not to read anything except the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous until you have 1 year of sobriety. I don't know why, but I listened to him. And I put all the other books away. And this was the only book I read for the first year. But as soon as I got my 1 year chip, and he told me about learning about the history, the first book I took off the shelf was Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And I took it down, and I started... I actually wasn't reading it. I was looking at the pictures, and there was a picture of Dr. Bob's house at 855 Ardmore Avenue. Well, I'd gotten sober in this little club on the northwest side of Tucson, and I took this book in, and I said, has anybody been to Akron? And nobody been to Akron. Does anybody know if Dr. Bob's house is even still standing? And nobody knew. And Phil says, well, find out. Well, that's me. I don't know. Find out. Well, I guess it would have been easy enough just to call Akron or something, but no. I got on an airplane and flew to Akron to find out if there was a Dr. Bob's house, because nobody in my group knew. And again, I was having a lot of trouble with the God part, and I thought maybe if I walked where they walked and saw what they saw, that maybe I'd start to feel what they felt. And I got off the airplane, I picked up the phone, and I called the intergroup office number in the phone book. I learned to do that, pick up the phone book and call AA. And the lady on the other end of the phone, this is Sunday morning, towards noon, and she said, not only is there a Dr. Bob's house, but they're having a meeting there today. And they only have one meeting a year. And it's in about 2 hours, and since you're here anyway, why don't you think about going there? And I said, okay, I'll do it. And she said, well, you can't find Dr. Bob's house from the airport. So she directed me to the Arid Club, which was right off a freeway ramp. I rented a car and drove across town and down the freeway ramp, and sure enough, the club was there. Two people were waiting for me. And they escorted me across town to Dr. Bob's house. And I arrived there 5 minutes before this meeting started. And there were about 100 people in Dr. Bob's house. It was a relatively small meeting, though Dr. Bob's house is relatively small anyway, so it was kind of packed to the rafters. But there were people all over the living room and up the stairs going to the upstairs bedrooms and packed in and... there was Sue Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, serving coffee in the kitchen. And there was a little table set up. It wasn't any bigger than this table in Dr. Bob's living room. And there were nine people around the table, and those were the speakers. And it was a speaker meeting. And the only requirement to speak is you had to have 40 years of sobriety. These people all knew Dr. Bob. These people all talked about the early days of AA. They, each and every one of them, talked about the simplicity of the program and the importance of carrying the message to the next alcoholic and how they had been doing that all their lives. And I realized this wasn't an accident. That this is how God works in our lives. It wasn't a burning bush, but when I put it all together, the chances of me setting out on this archival journey and ending up in Dr. Bob's living room for the only meeting that they hold each year, which is the second Sunday of November, it's a memorial service for Dr. Bob, because he died on the second Sunday in November in 1950. There's no other way for me to explain that. And my life has never been the same after that. And that was my spiritual experience, my spiritual awakening. And I've been on this archival journey ever since. That archival journey has carried me, has taken me all over the country. I am most fortunate, after being fired out of my third Fortune 500 company position, I went to work for a regional company, a chemical company, doing basically the same work. But this time, I can make my own hours and pretty much set my own schedules, which is what allows me to leave on Wednesdays and Thursdays and not get back till Tuesdays and Wednesdays the following week and still have a job. And I've actually been far more successful than I've ever been all the years I was drinking in doing the work that I'm doing, even though I'm not putting in the 40 and 60 hours a week that I used to put in. So God gave me a new job. He became my employer, which is just what this is all about. I turned my will and my life over to Him, and He's taken such good care of me ever since I did. Ever since I realized that this program truly is a miracle, and I didn't have a clue, sitting in those rooms in Tucson, Arizona, what this program was all about. But talking to old-timer after old-timer and archivist after archivist, I have gotten a deep, deep appreciation not only for Alcoholics Anonymous but also for the programs that led to the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned so much from studying the Oxford Group literature and going back even to the Washingtonians and seeing what has worked and what has not worked, and why we have to be so careful and so diligent, or Alcoholics Anonymous could go the same way as the Washingtonians, and we could become a past tense fellowship just as the Washingtonians if we don't stay close to our roots and our singleness of purpose. I want to close with one more story. I know it's getting late, but this incident took place right here at the Wilson House, and it was just shortly after Akron. Of course, I was in Akron in '89, and I was here for the first time in '92 to pick up that big book that that Peter provided for me. But this is also the first time that God truly spoke to me in loud, clear terms. And I recognized the voice because I'd heard the voice before. Before I get into what I heard here, I want to go back and explain why I thought the voice was the voice of God. Three times in the 1970s, while I was going through these periods of very active alcoholism, God spoke to me three times. The first time I was coming back from working late, and I was driving in Seattle, Washington area, and it was dark, and this voice, which sounded like it came from the back seat or the back of my head, said, "Go to Index and buy fence posts." Whoa, what was that? I'm not going to Index. I'm going home. Index, Washington, is 80 miles away, and it's already 8 o'clock at night. And if I get there, there aren't going to be any fence posts to buy anyway. What is this all about? But the voice was so loud, and it was so clear, it put me in fear. And so I turned the car around and drove to Index, Washington. And while I'm driving, I realized if I'm to buy fence posts, I have to go to the fence post store, which, of course, is going to be closed. But when I get to the fence post store an hour and a half later, about 9:30, quarter of 10, there's a light on in the mobile home in the back of the lot where they sell the fence posts. And I go through the lot, and I knock on the door. And a lady answers, and I said, "I'm here to buy fence posts." And she says, "I know, God told me you were coming." And I was in absolute shock. And this is a non-believer. And she took me in, and she belonged to the Seventh-day Adventist faith. We got down on our knees, and we prayed, and she read out of the Bible. And I stopped drinking for about 6 months in the Seventh-day Adventist church, going to church services with them, with her and her husband. But again, the alcohol just took over, and I was back to the races. God spoke to me the second time I was on a skiing expedition. What I had done as part of being a middle manager of a Fortune 500 company was I'd put together this ski outing, and it was at Mount Baker, and we'd invited all of the buying people at the various oil refineries and paper mills in the area. There were about 30, 40 people up on the mountain slopes, and we'd paid for their tickets, and we'd rented the ski lodge condominium down below. And I'm the last one to get there because I'm making sure that everybody gets up to the mountain and everybody gets their ski tickets and off they go. And it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon before I get there. And my boss is skiing down the mountain as I get there. And he says, "Okay, the mobile people are up on this slope. The Intalco people are over here. I'm taking the Texaco people into lunch. And why don't you go up and catch up with one of the two groups that are still on the slopes?" And I said, "Fine, I will." And I take the lift up to the top. Get halfway up the mountain and a blizzard starts, an absolute whiteout blizzard. And I'd never been on this mountain before. I did have a map of the ski slopes, but when I got off the lift, so many people were skiing away that I couldn't even find anybody to follow. And so I started down on my own, and then all of a sudden there were two people, and I could see them ahead of me. And they would ski for a while, and I would ski for a while, and they would ski for a while, and I would ski for a while. And then all of a sudden they hollered back to me, "Don't come any further, we're lost." I said, "Great, how am I going to get out of here? I can't even see." And they said, "Well, we're going to the left." And I was a good alcoholic. I said, "Well, I'll go to the right." So they went to the left and skied to safety, and I went to the right and skied off the edge of the earth. What happened is I ended up skiing into this bowl, which I found out later had been dynamited for avalanche protection, and I lost my balance, and I'm rolling, and I'm rolling, and I'm rolling. And the voice says, "Kick off your damn skis." Well, God talked to me. It sounded very clear to me. I mean, he even swore at me, "Kick off your damn skis." But he got my attention, and I reached down to pull off the bindings, and this branch went by, and I grabbed this branch as I'm pulling off one of my bindings, and then I reach down and pull off the other bindings, holding onto this branch, and now it's just like a Hollywood movie. I watch the skis drop 200 feet straight down to the rocks below, and I'm hanging off the edge of a cliff. If I had not grabbed that branch to kick off my skis, I certainly wouldn't be here today. It took a 7 ski patrol, 2.5 hours to rescue me. And when the first of the rescue party got to me, this Norwegian guy who was on the ski patrol, he said, "You know, you're only the second person to try this jump." And the first guy died on impact. So, the third time, I'm coming back from Eastern Washington. I'm doing some consulting work over at the nuclear reservation at Hanford. And I decide to come back across the mountain in the middle of a snowstorm to get back to the other side. And as I'm driving around Mount Rainier, there's a sign to the right that says, "To Paradise, road closed for the winter," and the road to the left. which is the road home. And the voice says, take the road to the right. Now, this one I cannot believe, because this is a closed road, closed for the winter. There's already 3-4 inches of snow on the ground. Why would I take the road to the right? It's 20 miles around this loop to get back to the road that I originally would have stayed on. And I took the road to the right. And it took me over an hour to get close to paradise, to the summit, knowing that all I was going to do was just come back down the other side. And I'm slipping and I'm sliding and I'm going about 10 miles an hour and it's snowing in my face. And I don't even see anything, but then there's a thump on the top of the car. And it jogs me into reality, and I stopped the car. What was that? A guy had jumped on my car. He saw me coming by, and I didn't see him. And I'm just tooling. So he jumps on the back of the car to get me to stop. And what had happened is that two people that were on their honeymoon from San Francisco had taken the road to the right and had gotten stuck at the top. And they were there within minutes of dying of hypothermia. The car had already run out of gasoline. They had no winter clothes. And they were stuck. And I got them in the car, and I got them down off the mountain and down to the forest ranger station and turned them over to them there. And they were just so grateful, and they said that I'd saved their life. I believe that I had. So those are the three times that I heard the voice. And then I didn't hear it again for 15 years. A lot of those years I would sit in bar rooms crying in my beer that God didn't love me, that God didn't talk to me anymore. Well, how could he get through that alcohol haze? That's what I didn't realize at the time. That's why I realized, all this was just a fluke. I mean, he hadn't talked to me in 15 years. Well, he talked to me when I got to the Wilson House here to pick up that book. And Peter had said that he had found this book that was so rare that he didn't dare ship it in the mail, but that I would have to come pick it up here at the Wilson House. And I'd never been, I hadn't been east. I had not been back east in over 25 years. I was raised in this area, but I didn't want people to know I was a active practicing alcoholic, and so I'd lost all contact with everybody back here. In fact, I'd never even been back here as an adult. So this is my first trip back east. Get to the Wilson House, and that night get a good night's sleep, and we're going to have the ceremony the next day. And in my morning meditation, by that time I'd learned enough of Oxford Group and Step 11 to perform a morning meditation and wait for guidance. And the voice returns. And the voice says, you're not here to buy a big book. Whoa. See, none of these statements are profound in and of themselves, but this is what God was saying. You're not here to buy a big book. I said, oh, okay, thank you. And so I come down the stairs, and Peter's coming in with the book. And I said, well, Peter, the deal's off. God spoke to me and told me, I'm not here to buy a big book. And Peter says, I'll say that again. And I said, well, God spoke to me this morning. And he didn't say, oh, come on now. What are you talking about? God spoke to you this morning. The only thing he said was, what did he say? And I said, Peter, he said, you're not here to buy a big book. And Peter says, well, that could mean that you're here for some other purpose, over and above buying this big book. I said, oh, okay. So we went through with it, and we had the little ceremony right there in the living room, where, in the corner with the light on where Bill was born. And, of course, I'm talking about it at the evening meal and how God talked to me and how I'm just so excited that God's back in my life. And the next morning, I get a knock on my door, and I answer the door, and She says, my name is Deborah, and I couldn't help but overhear what you said last night, and I think I'm here to listen to what you have to say. And I said, how so? And she said, I've been in this fellowship for 5 years. And she said, and I'm absolutely miserable. I live in Los Angeles. I was attending a convention in San Francisco. I was ready to pack it in. I was not getting anywhere. And I was going to fly to Los Angeles and commit suicide. And I heard a voice, and the voice told me to go to the Wilson House. So instead of flying from San Francisco to Los Angeles, she flew to Albany and rented a car and had been at the Wilson House for 6 days, waiting for something. And she said 6 days was as long as I was going to wait. Today is the day I am going to commit suicide. If something doesn't happen today. And she said, what do you have to say? And I was absolutely speechless for a minute. And I said, well, I don't know why you feel so separate from, because that's not the AA that I have learned about in studying the history of AA. What I've learned is that AA is all-inclusive and that everybody's welcome, no matter who they are. That Bill Wilson didn't care whether you were black, brown, red, green, or purple. If you were an alcoholic, you were welcome in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't care if you were a man or a woman, gay or straight, old or young. The rooms are for you if you're an alcoholic. And I told her additional stories from the 12 and 12 about the tradition of the person that had come into the group in Akron that said that he had had an affliction even worse than alcoholism and didn't know whether the group would accept him. And sure enough, there was controversy in the group. And some wanted to vote him out, and some said, oh, no, let him stay. And then Dr. Bob intervened and said very clearly and very concisely, what would the master do? And he was allowed to stay. And I asked her to think on those same terms. What would the master do? The master does not want you to commit suicide. The master wants you to grow in a spiritual recovery, into spiritual recovery within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to pass on to you what was passed on to me, and that is to learn something about the history of AA and learn about our miraculous past. And then I started to tell story after story after story of what had been handed down to me about our history, some of which I had related this afternoon, some of which I'll be relating tomorrow. And she said, thank you. And I didn't see her the rest of that day, but the next day I had to leave because I had another appointment on my spiritual journey. And I was down in the kitchen saying goodbye to Ozzy and Bonnie and the staff, and Deborah comes down the stairs and into the kitchen, and she gives me a big kiss and throws her arms around me, and she says, God was right. You weren't here to buy a big book. You were here to live the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for saving my life. And that happened right here in the kitchen of this house in 1992. And even though I've not heard the voice since in such loud terms, I still hear a voice that's loud enough each and every morning to write down the guidance that I receive. I spend a little time asking God for that guidance, and then I wait patiently to hear what He has to say. And I consider that to be an integral part of my recovery. Not only do I write it down, but I have to share it with another person that also is in tune with the guidance. I just can't share that with anybody because there's a lot of people, many people inside these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that don't have a clue as to what I'm talking about right now. And I consider that to be a shame. I consider that to be a travesty. Because that's living in the solution. That's not only turning our will and our lives over to the care of God, but allowing God into our lives and to speak to us directly so that we can help save other lives. And that's what I realize, even though I don't know how, where, when, or how, when, or where, each time God speaks to me, somewhere along the line, a life is saved, even if it's my own. It has certainly helped keep me sober on this spiritual journey and on this archival journey to learn about our early days. And if anybody else has gotten sober along the way, I can report that I did talk to Deborah 6 months after that incident, and she was in Los Angeles, and she had joined the archives committee for her district and was dutifully studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have other stories, but I'm going to go ahead and close for now, and we can talk about it after the meeting. And after the meeting, I want Jim to come up, Jim Houck, and explain to us what his guidance has been today, and something that we're going to ask all of you to partake in, and that is to make a commitment to carry this message back to your home groups after this meeting is concluded tomorrow, and not just sit here and listen, but to actually become actively involved in saving our fellowship by carrying the message about the early days and about the importance of the spiritual solution. And that's why I want to close with my sponsor Phil's favorite page. This is the page that was ratty and torn and marked up and barely legible in his big book. And it says, "There is a solution. Almost none of us liked the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And I am living proof that those words are true as true can be. My life has changed and changed dramatically as a result of the spiritual solution." And I do want to close with a prayer, and if you'd help me with this. God, I pray that we never forget who we are, where we came from, and what our primary purpose is. I pray that we never forget who made all of this possible. And I pray that we always remember, there but for the grace of God go I. Thank you.